This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, December 13th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And we'll speak with Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. New research from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution shows the likely path that radioactive water would take if it were discharged from the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station and how long it would stay in Cape Cod Bay. Also this week, a new initiative targeting 20 Cape Cod boat ramps aims to reduce pollution of bays and freshwater ponds. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has those stories, and she is joining us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Great to be here, Steve.
Let's talk first about the Woods Hole research. This was done in direct response to community concerns about what would happen to radioactive water released from the Pilgrim nuclear plant. The company that owns Pilgrim, Holtec, has proposed disposing of the water into Cape Cod Bay. Right now, I think we're talking about a little under a million gallons somewhere in that neighborhood. Tell us about some of the top-line findings from this study.
Sure. So this study was just published in the Journal of Physical Oceanography, and it focuses on water circulation in Cape Cod Bay and what would happen to water released from Pilgrim. Three of the four authors are from the study are from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and they simulated where water would go if it were released from Pilgrim and how fast it would move. One of the biggest takeaways here is that the water would not leave the bay right away. So the model showed that after 3 weeks, only 12% of water particles from Pilgrim would be likely to leave Cape Cod Bay in the spring and summer. And then in the colder weather, it would actually be even less. So if you look at a month out from any discharge of the reactor system water from the nuclear plant, it's likely that the vast majority of that water would still be in the bay a month out. And that, you know, that really raises questions that residents have been asking all along about the possibility of contaminants settling into the sediment, getting into fish, shellfish, washing up on shore and things like that. So another finding from this study is that the water from Pilgrim would indeed move close to the shoreline, including places like Dennis, Wellfleet, and Provincetown. So it is not a situation where the water would just kind of swirl in the middle of the bay and then move out. This research shows it would go close to the shoreline.
Can you talk a little bit about how the researchers came to these conclusions? It's not like they put anything into the water themselves for this particular study. They're using mathematical modeling. Is that right?
That's right. But it is a high-resolution model of ocean currents that was developed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So they simulated water releases according to that model to see where different, they actually call them parcels, different spots of water would move along in the bay based on that model. They also used some previous data from what are called drifters, which are basically like untethered buoys that float around with the current. So some drifter data was used to validate the mathematical model here.
Now, if some of this data sounds familiar, that's because we had a bit of a preview of it on the News Roundup last week. This study has now been published, but this is the same data that was discussed at the state panel on Pilgrim. Tell us about what the research means, really, in the context of what's happening with the decommissioning of the power plant.
Yes, well, I mean, this research could certainly influence some decision making about that reactor system water. It's hard to say how much of a difference it could make. This research pointed out the seasonality of the currents so that things are a little different in the warm weather versus the cold weather. That's one potential area of influence. Like, you know, if the water does in fact get released, would it be released in the spring and summer to clear out of the bay a little bit faster? Although when I think about that, you know, the idea of the summertime publicity about that could work against releasing in the summer. And those seasonal differences, again, are pretty small. So I don't know if that will be a factor. This study is bringing some extra attention to the idea in general of exposure to, radioactive material in the bay. But Holtec's position, the owner of Pilgrim, their position after seeing this research is still unchanged. And what they've been saying is that they have discharged millions of gallons of this type of water in the bay, which they say is safe. That was happening while the plant was operating. So Holtec says the overall effect of Pilgrim on the bay has been negligible, and that would be the case going forward in their view. I'll just mention one more thing about the model used in this research, and that it was not able to address what would happen to particles in the water once they touch land. So this really was just about the movement of the water itself.
What happens next now that this research is out? Do you have a sense?
Well, I talked with one of the authors of this study, Irina Rypina from Woods Hole Oceanographic. She said, in terms of future research along these lines, one good follow-up study could be to look at what would happen if the Pilgrim water were released into deeper water, because this model that they used deals with near-surface water. So that's one thing in terms of the pure research. But then, speaking more globally about Pilgrim and what's next, it's still true that this water discharge issue is likely to wind up in court. It's under a state appeal right now, a state administrative appeals process where Holtec is seeking to appeal a state decision, and that's similar to a court case. But it is going to be probably come down to a legal decision at some point.
Okay, I want to talk about another water quality story that you reported this week. Very different one. This is about boat ramps in Cape Cod, trying to reduce stormwater runoff from boat ramps going into local waterways, both freshwater and saltwater. Start by telling us a little bit about the problem here. Why boat ramps?
Yeah, so boat ramps can be a direct point of discharge where rain does not have much chance to soak into the ground and to be cleaned naturally the way it would before it goes into a body of water. So whether the water is a lake, a pond, a bay, something like that, a boat ramp is going to have a cleared area, right, by the water's edge, lack of vegetation. It's going to have a parking area that's also cleared where, vehicles could be dripping oil and all of that. So a lot of them also actually have, neighborhoods, homes nearby. So there are different sources of contamination that would be in stormwater runoff that could then be running down these boat ramps into the water. Stormwater carries things like grease and oil, bacteria from animal waste or from septic systems, and then nutrients that get into it, like nitrogen and phosphorus that are bad for the ponds. So that's what this initiative is meant to address. It involves building structures and planting plants that will help filter the water naturally. And when I say boat ramps here, not all of them are sort of paved or concrete things that you might commonly picture. This also includes launch spots, right, for like kayaks and canoes. I went to visit a site like that on Scargo Lake in Dennis, and it just has a small beachy area where people do launch boats.
Tell us about when you went to see this boat launch ramp in along Scargo Lake. What is it exactly that's happening there, and what are they doing to intervene?
Yes, there are two launch spots on different sides of Scargo Lake. I went to the one that is on Dr. Lord's Road South there in Dennis. And again, since it's a small spot, a small launch spot, one of the biggest things that you see there is the parking lot. And then there's the sort of the grassy and sandy area where people access the water. But the parking lot has been completely redone with porous pavement. I wasn't too familiar with that. It looks pretty much like regular pavement from a distance or from casual observation. But if you look closely, you can see that there's more space between the solids and the pavement, and water can actually soak right through it into what is below, which is gravel and sand, and then eventually into the ground. So that, of course, helps to clean those contaminants out before the water reaches the lake. The town of Dennis is working on this project in conjunction with the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. They have also built some other structures at the site. One is a gravel trench between the parking lot and the water. So, in a heavy storm, if water actually runs off the parking lot, it would go down through the gravel trench. And they have what's called a bioretention facility, which is just kind of like a low area of ground that will be planted with some plants that help soak up the water.
Real briefly, you said this is part of a larger initiative. What other boat ramps could be on the list for this kind of similar work?
Yes, well, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod has created a priority list of 20 boat ramps in 10 different towns. So I won't list them all, but some that are the farthest along in the process, almost ready for construction, are Mashpee Wakeby Pond in Mashpee, Follins Pond in Yarmouth, and the Herring River in Harwich.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right, thank you, Steve.
The annual report card that grades the health of Cape Cod's ponds, embayments, and drinking water is out. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details on this story and more and joins us. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
So we're going to stay with talking about water quality here. This week, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod released its sixth annual State of the Waters report. Let's start with what they say about the water that Cape Codders are drinking.
Sure. So for the second year in a row, 19 of the Cape's 21 public drinking water supplies received an excellent water quality score, and none received a poor score. Of course, we're not looking at well water drinkers here. This is our public waters. Now, the two public water supplies, the Buzzards Bay Water District and the Bourne Water District, that got just good water quality scores did so because they detected but then treated for some bacteria in their water. So it shouldn't be a concern to locals. Now, that said, almost half of the water supplies on the Cape have PFAS chemicals in their source water. It is below the regulated amount, and Massachusetts has pretty much the best regulations out of any state in the country when it comes to PFAS, but in drinking water. But APCC is calling for more study because, look, exposure to these chemicals, especially just in bulk, has been linked to a bunch of health problems like cancer, fertility issues, thyroid disease. The list is quite long.
How about ponds and embayments? And an embayment is just kind of a technical word for how our coastline is kind of broken up into bays and inlets and similar shapes. What did the report say about these water bodies?
Yeah, the report found that about 90% of these embayments, as you describe, and about a quarter of tested ponds on Cape Cod have unacceptable water quality. Really high numbers. 90% of embayments, about a quarter of ponds. Now, according to the report, there's been a decrease in the number of ponds graded as unacceptable from about 37% to 28% compared to last year, but APCC says the improvement is not enough. Meanwhile, as far as marine environments, just 10% of embayments were deemed acceptable, excuse me. And in 2019, the number was about 32%. So we see this real kind of downward score. It's not good.
Big takeaways from this report? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, 6 years of data makes the problems really clear, right? So septic waste from our septic systems, stormwater runoff, and excessive fertilizer use has degraded our waters. And that's really concerning. Like, the problems are deeply clear. But the good news is that sewer expansion plans, fertilizer bans, and other water protection efforts, some more on the natural side, make the APCC team somewhat optimistic about the future. They say it'll just take time to see improvements.
Let us talk about another story that you covered this week. Provincetown officials deployed a new tool to fight flooding when the region was hit this week with a storm that really brought high winds and rains and power outages. Can you describe this system? And what does this mean that they have a new system to combat flooding?
Yeah. Okay. So the DPW workers, I just want to give you the scene here. They roll up to this area in the East End, right by the ice house, actually, that kind of helps orient people. And there are a bunch of historic houses right there. And in their trucks, they've got dozens of these red plastic barriers all stacked together. And then as they unload them and start setting them up, you get this sense of how they work. So each one is L-shaped, about 4 feet high, about as many feet wide. And you can kind of imagine it as Santa's sled is what they look like. And they click together, and then they're weighed down by some sandbags. And if floodwaters breach the seawall right at the shore, then these are out, and they should be able to, they should be watertight, and they should stop water from actually reaching homes. The thing is, this is kind of all an experiment. This is a pilot project. We don't really know how much they will work yet. But having watched the DPW workers actually put them out, they felt really good about the ease of working with this system. That matters here. And this last storm wasn't much of a test in the end. So we still don't really know how well they worked.
In some sense, this last storm was really a test for the deployment, being able to show up with them and drop them down on the street and assemble it really quickly.
Yep.
This is part of a larger effort by the town to fight coastal flooding, which is becoming an increasing problem. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so town voters in Provincetown approved a $150,000 capital improvement program earlier this year to buy these barriers. But with that money, they were also able to buy a quick fill sandbag machine, which has allowed the DPW to quickly make sandbags available to anyone in town who wants them for free during severe weather events. They'll be at the DPW Highway Garage located at 24 Race Point Road. The town is also in the midst of a comprehensive coastal resilience plan. So it includes projections for sea level rise, storm surge, erosion impacts all the way through 2070. Has some short-term and long-term ideas to strengthen Provincetown's resilience to climate change. And ultimately, it should be a roadmap for site-specific and townwide adaptation projects, policies, and priorities.
Okay, finally, I want to talk about two whales that washed up dead across the region. Mm-hmm. First, tell us about what an animal response team found in Plymouth this week.
Yeah, so Whale and Dolphin Conservation, the group responding to this Plymouth stranding, says that they identified a young male that washed up with rope or fishing gear attached to its flipper. Now, this entanglement could be related, of course, to the cause of death. They're still trying to make sense of that. Whales sometimes also, you know, have an entanglement, carry it for a long time, and then get hit by a boat. Or, of course, disease could be at play. So we can't say that is definitively the cause of death, but it's certainly going to be investigated. This is the fourth whale to be found on beaches between Plymouth and Weymouth in just 6 months. The last three were minke whales. So the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Team said it has been a very busy time for them, unusually busy.
And yesterday, in another part of our coastline, you got news of another whale coming ashore, this one in Wellfleet.
Yeah, so a dead minke whale was washed ashore in Wellfleet. It was the second minke whale to be found in the town's shores in just over a month. For this one, the responder was the International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFAW. They were taking control of the effort to do a post-mortem exam. Yesterday, they checked in on the whale and then had to go help a live stranded dolphin. But then they plan to return to the whale today to hopefully do a necropsy, an animal necropsy. And yeah, again, these numbers are interesting. The Cape Cod Times reported that strandings of minke whales occur not infrequently across Cape Cod. They describe a 2021 near Sesuit Harbor in Dennis in 2019. There's one in Provincetown, one off Barnstable Harbor in 2018. And overall, you know, there is what's called an unusual mortality event going on between kind of along the Atlantic coast for minke whales. There's just a lot washing up dead. And the largest share has been found in Massachusetts. So people hear us cover right whales a lot, but there are many other whales, many of whom are facing the exact same problems. And it was unfortunately a big week for some of the other whales.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break right now. When we come back, we'll speak to Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Housing development on Martha's Vineyard is often fraught, and the Martha's Vineyard Commission often finds itself at the center of challenging decisions. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here with the story of two high-profile developments. Hi, Ethan.
Morning, Steve.
Let's start with the development on Meeting House Way in Edgartown. This has gone through a few iterations now. The developers are coming with a third plan, and it has a new name.
Yeah, no, this one's going to be called Katema Meadows. It's like you said, this project has been controversial in the past and it's kind of morphed since 2018 when it was kind of initially proposed. What we have now is it's kind of the outskirts of Edgartown. It's they're looking at kind of this 54-acre swath of land. They're looking at 36 rental units for low-income folks, 12 duplexes for year-round residents, and 26 single-family lots.
Some of the earlier iterations of this project, when it was originally put forward, there was a lot of concern about the number of high-dollar properties that were being created as opposed to creating housing for year-round islanders.
Yeah, one commissioner called it a development for millionaires, and that kind of drew so a lot of criticism from the community and the commission, which denied this project once. So it seems like the developers are kind of coming back to the table with this new plan, hoping that this is a little more palatable. It's something that has been kind of tied up in the courts, as you mentioned. These often end up in courtrooms and such. So it's been pretty controversial and about kind of, you know, does this fit into the in a community that is in a dire housing crisis?
Briefly, this goes where next? To the Edgartown Planning Board first?
Yeah, it'll go to the Edgartown Planning Board. It's set to go there next week. They'll probably almost assuredly then kick it up to the Martha's Vineyard Commission, which is our island-wide review committee. It's kind of one of the only kinds of its ilk in the state, along with the Cape Cod Commission.
And then I want to talk about the other project that's going on right now. This is the developers of the Green Villa project in Oak Bluffs. They're looking, it sounds like they're looking kind of to try to cut the Martha's Vineyard Commission out of the review process.
Yeah, so as we kind of mentioned, you know, the Martha's Vineyard Commission is this kind of overarching body for large development here on the island. And this has been something that's been kicked around before is some folks might know this called 40B, which is the state housing law. It allows developers to kind of streamline everything into one single application with the Zoning Board of Appeals in the local towns. And it's done that way to give developers who kind of build affordable housing a kind of a, like I said, a streamlined application, kind of get things moving. And so the question is, if you do that, do you still have to go to the Martha's Vineyard Commission? Historically, pretty much all these large projects have. Someone tried to fight that once and ended up losing, and Green Villa seems to be picking up that battle now again.
So Green Villa, the proposal is, it's a large apartment housing complex and geared entirely for affordable housing. Is that right?
Not entirely, but there's going to be 100 apartments is the plan, which is a lot for here in Martha's Vineyard. And there's also kind of plans for retail stores at the spot. It's going to be over by like the YMCA and the ice rink, if people know that area over there in Oak Bluffs. And yeah, it's we haven't really seen many proposals like this in the past. So it's interesting that they're saying, you know, we shouldn't have to go to the Martha's Vineyard Commission. That is also kicking around in multiple legal battles right now.
One of the interesting points that you point to in your article here is that the Martha's Vineyard Commission actually was founded, was, you know, created before the 40B law. And so that's kind of, they're saying they have precedent here. They can't be cut out of the process.
Yeah, and it was something, there was a very controversial development about 20 years ago, kind of around the same area. And, you know, a judge said the Martha's Vineyard Commission does deserve to be and has the right to be involved in these kind of projects. And so they're trying to stake their claim, saying, yes, we should be in here. Greenville is arguing to the state that, no, you don't. They're kind of leaning on saying, you know, this is too big of a hurdle if you want affordable housing on our island here.
Because they're afraid of what the Martha's Vineyard Commission, how they might view the project? Like, what do we know
that
about?
That would be the assumption. They didn't really want to talk about it. They're kind of saying the state 40B law allows you to kind of get around that. It says, you know, local boards, only one local board is supposed to kind of review a project in one kind of comprehensive application. And they're saying the Martha's Vineyard is a local board. Whether Whether that's true or not, we'll probably have a judge will probably end up telling us someday in the coming years.
Or I guess they could just be leaning into wanting the process to be as streamlined as quick as possible.
Yeah.
Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge has been under the steady, watchful eye of an on-site manager for a number of years. That is now about to change. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
The manager is stepping down, and it's a bit of a question about how soon or even if the position will be filled. Tell us about Rick Nyes and what he does for the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge.
Sure. Rick Nye has been the on-site manager for the Monomoy Refuge, which has property on the mainland of Morris Island, but is focused on the 7,000-acre Monomoy Islands, which go off the south of Chatham, which, it's a migratory bird habitat that is considered one of the most important on the East Coast. And, the bird colony sort of goes along on its own. Birds do what they're going to do. But much of Rick's responsibilities in the last few years have focused on the Morris Island side of the refuge, where, as we've spoken before, there's been extensive erosion, and that's resulted in the loss of basically all the buildings on there on the fish and wildlife property on Morris Island. The refuge is going through a real change, both physically and now management-wise. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen with Rick's position. He's taken a new job with the Fish and Wildlife Service, which will transfer him to their the headquarters for the Northeast region, which is in Hadley. Mm. And the Monomoy Refuge at this point, at least in the near term, will be overseen by the project leader at the Eastern Massachusetts National Wildlife Refuge Complex, which is based in Sudbury. Monomoy is a subdivision of that. But officials tell me that they're not sure if Rick's position is going to be filled for a number of reasons.
Well, talk about that a little bit. And also, I'm curious because the town of Chatham really feels like it has a stake in seeing this position filled.
Definitely. Town officials told me they would really want to see an on-site refuge manager for Chatham. You know, the town and the Fish and Wildlife have a bit of a relationship that has some history to it that goes back quite a number of years, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's a bit rocky. It's been pretty good under Rick Nye. Officials say they've been able to keep updated on what's going on at the refuge. And but the question is, I don't know how much input the town is going to have in this, but, you know, we've got a lot of changes happening, obviously, at the national level. We've got a new presidential administration coming in, and, we know what they're looking at as far as maybe reducing some of the federal workforce. And the project leader of the Eastern Massachusetts National Refuge Complex told us that, their usual quote that they're reviewing the situation and the position, and they're going to determine after the change in administration what's going to happen with that position. So we could end up with a non on-site manager for Monomoy, or they could fill that position. We just don't know it at this point.
But there are staff members there at the Wildlife Refuge, even if that management position is going away.
That's correct. The refuge, this last year they had to demolish their office and visitor center to keep it from tumbling over the bluff because of the erosion. But they have rented a space in West Chatham from the Chatham Conservation Foundation.
Tim.
Summer they'll have two staff members who are here full time. In the near term, a biologist and a facilities person, and they'll continue doing what they have been doing in overseeing the islands and making sure that the migratory shorebird situation is remains it has always been.
It is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. A proposal to build a marine sanctuary visitor center in Provincetown at McMillan Pier appears to have lost its primary funding. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what's happened. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
We have talked about this project in the past, but maybe you'd better remind us what it was supposed to be and why there were concerns around it already.
Yes. So the Gary E. Studs Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary has existed for decades, and there's been planning for a visitor center in Provincetown for more than 20 years. That was first discussed back in 2002, I believe. The sanctuary is an 842 square mile underwater reserve that runs from just north of Race Point at the tip of the Cape to just off Gloucester on Cape Ann. And there's been a partnership basically of three entities, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the town of Provincetown, and the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown to create this visitor center. The NOAA had allocated $15 million in funding from the Inflation Reduction Act for the project and expected the town to provide the land and additional funding to pay for education programs about the sanctuary. And back in 2021, the select board in Provincetown had recommended a site at the base of McMillan Pier in the center of town for the project after a feasibility study that had been done back in 2017. But when the discussion of the project came up this past August, there were a lot of objections, both to the size of the building and the location.
And also the cost, which was going to exceed the $15 million seed grant there, and the town would essentially be on the hook for all of sort of maintaining that building going forward. There were a lot of discussions about that.
That's right. So the estimate of the cost of this building, which was over 10,000 square feet, 10,850 square feet, the cost was estimated at $21.3 million back in 2021. And when it came up before the select board, Leslie Sandberg, one of the board members, said, well, you know, there's a $6.3 million funding gap that the town is going to have to make up between the 15 and the 21.3. And in addition, it's going to cost another $3.5 million to relocate the 60 parking places in the municipal parking lot at the base of the pier that the project would eliminate. And she worried that the cost estimate back in 2021 would really not be that accurate.
So I don't want to bury the lead too far here, because what's happened now, while there was a lot of sort of ambivalence in the town about whether this was a good idea, now that seed money, that $15 million grant, appears to have gone away.
Yeah. So what happened was that the select board voted on September the 9th to ask NOAA to consider other locations. But a week before that, the sanctuary superintendent, Peter DiCola, had actually written to the board saying that the agency was facing an end-of-year deadline for allocating the money and would not have time to study new locations. So after the board voted, they got a letter in October from NOAA saying it's not possible to dedicate Inflation Reduction Act funding to this venture, given the lack of an identified location. And so the $15 million is gone.
It doesn't look like the idea of a marine sanctuary, however, is entirely gone. It just may not be in Provincetown, or it may be reconceived. Is that right?
Well, there'll have to be a whole new feasibility study done. And Peter DeCola, the superintendent, says that NOAA still wants to see this visitor center in Provincetown someday. We think Provincetown is the right location, he said. We just need to find the right spot in town. And they want it to be somewhere that would draw foot traffic, that would boost visitor numbers, which was, of course, why McMillan Pier was seemed like an attractive spot for it. But among other problems, like the displacing the municipal parking lot, people pointed out that that spot is in what's called a velocity zone, a FEMA zone that's especially vulnerable to flooding. And other people objected just to the design of the building, how large it would be, and how it would really change the whole appearance of the entrance to town. It's really not clear at this point what will happen. It's basically back to square one.
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
Christmas Stroll is one of the biggest single weekends for business downtown on Nantucket, which made this past weekend especially devastating for the many businesses that lost power for 30 hours. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has this painful story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
It's almost unbelievable to conceive of how these businesses could lose electricity right at this moment and not be able to see it restored.
It really is, and that's one of the longest power outages that the island has experienced, or part of the island has experienced, in decades, really. Even at some of the massive winter storms we've had, power has been restored more quickly than it was over the weekend. But it was a 27-plus-hour outage, and nobody is still really sure exactly what the cause of the underground cable failure was that left parts of the downtown without power on Saturday into Sunday of Christmas Stroll. Representatives from National Grid were at the select board meeting on Wednesday night. They say that the faulty cables are now being examined at one of their labs to determine the cause, but that process could take weeks. The outage occurred Saturday morning around 10:20 a.m., right before the start of the Christmas Stroll parade, when there was still several thousand people downtown, and not restored again by National Grid to the last 200 or 300 customers until around 2 p.m. on Sunday. More than a dozen bars and restaurants had to cancel their Stroll service after being without power for that long. The company said two sections of faulty underground electric cable that serviced much of the downtown area were what failed, and that left about half of the downtown businesses, one entire side of Main Street, without power. It's still also unclear what recourse, if any, those businesses have in terms of compensation for the loss of business. The state's Department of Public Utilities has reached out to National Grid saying that it's going to be evaluating whether the outage, which initially impacted more than 1,400 customers, and National Grid's response complied with all state and federal regulations. It's still early on, but the director of the Chamber of Commerce out here said 208 chamber members were affected by the outage. And then as of the other day, about only 50 had returned surveys, but they had also reported $1.3 million in lost revenue and $130,000 in lost employee gratuities. And that especially hit hard to a lot of these employees that actually were not still on the island for Stroll. They had left sometime in the fall, gone to their either off-island residences or their winter off-season jobs, but came back, paid out of their own pocket to come back, whether it was to fly or to bus or to boat back, to make some really needed money over the weekend, and they were left completely out in the cold.
These restaurants, they lost their full Saturday and also really their Sunday, and these restaurants were booked full, as you report.
They were completely booked solid, and they did lose their Sunday business largely as well, because once the power went out and those walk-in coolers and those freezers were without power, the Board of Health sent some representatives down, and there are very specific rules about what temperature food has to be maintained at in order to be served in commercial establishments, and many of those walk-ins and freezers did not maintain that temp, and all that food not only was not able to be served, it had to be thrown out.
Mm. and just no way for businesses to make all that lost revenue up. Hey, I want to ask you about another story. The erosion control project at the Sconset Bluff has been in the news for years. For a while, it looked like these immense, they're called geotubes, were going to be ordered to be removed. But now it may be that the area they protect will be expanded. It's looking to get some approval.
Exactly. And not only is the removal order on hold, but there is an application for a major expansion that the Conservation Commission last week gave at least a preliminary go-ahead to. They voted to provide the project with a number of necessary waivers needed to move forward. The joint application by the town and the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, which is the private organization that has been pushing this project for over a decade now, to expand the geotubes at the base of the bluff from the current 900-foot length to nearly 5,000 feet, has been in front of the commission since January. The CONCOM still has to work its way through an order of conditions for the project before taking a final vote on whether to allow it to ultimately proceed. But this vote last Wednesday to issue the waivers was the first real indication of how commissioners feel about the project that they've been hearing about for nearly a year. And all indications are at this point that it looks like there's at least a pathway forward.
Hmm. Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Why did Vineyard Wind's turbine blade fail? That's the headline of a new in-depth story from Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. It's a great read with a lot of new information. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light joins us now. Hi, Anastasia.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks as always for having me.
Take us back to this day, July 13th, this past summer. You start the piece kind of revisiting what happened that day, but with some details that we hadn't heard before. Walk us through what we now know about what happened.
Yeah, so it's a little bit more detail, and we're really trying to cobble together whatever we can, and FOIA requests help, right? But, you know, this happened out of sight, really far offshore, so we have some new information that, you know, this, what we did already know is this problematic blade was on a turbine that was undergoing routine testing before it could start sending power to the grid. And it was undergoing testing for only about 6 hours when an alarm went off. The turbines have automatic alarms, and it signaled that there was a high vibration on blade one, and this prompted a total shutdown of the turbine. And so a helicopter crew was sent out, and subsequently drones were sent out to get eyes on this. And that's when they were able to see and spot that, you know, there's an issue here. There was this blade break and fracture. So that's how we started this story, trying to weave in a little bit more detail with, you know, as we continue this coverage to give more insight as to what happened here.
Now, the blades at the Vineyard Wind site, these are very specific blades. These are some of the biggest turbine blades in the world, and they're only used in a couple of locations right now. There's the Vineyard Wind site and a site in England. It's still not clear exactly what's happened, but the company is saying that there's something that they refer to as insufficient bonding, and you take a real look at how these blades are made. But even backing up, do we have a sense of how many blades fail generally? I mean, offshore wind has been going on for a while worldwide.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what I was trying to get at as well. It's a question that many people have been asking at public meetings since the incident. You know, they want to know if this is something that's going to continue happening. And I mean, there isn't really a satisfactory answer here. Experts say it is a pretty rare event, a catastrophic failure like this. And you know, there are right now about 39,000 blades operating and worldwide for offshore projects. We don't really have an exact number, though, on failure rate. This is because a lot of the companies, they have proprietary data and information. And it's also complicated by the fact that, you know, blades are growing larger and larger, and there's just not sufficient data to sort of get at, you know, is there a sort of a trend or an issue or a general rate that they could expect to happen as these blades are growing in size?
Just to give people a sense of the scale here, this is a single blade and each turbine has three blades on it. It's longer than a football field, weighs 55 tons. They're made somewhat in the way that you can imagine a fiberglass boat being made. They have a fiberglass type shell and composite materials put together. It's an industrial object, but it takes an incredible amount of handwork. And you kind of described this for us in the piece, that they have giant molds that they're laying up. Can you describe how a blade goes together a little bit?
Yeah, I'll definitely try my best. I got some help by watching videos. But there are these two molds. They're sort of called clamshells that they eventually come together. But you have a lot of what's called, touches, a lot of people, walking in the molds, working on this, and they're really very much handmade items. And so they're laying out the fiberglass that is, cut in a certain way. It's like putting together puzzle pieces. It's really precise, and they're putting a lot of layers of this down. They eventually pump it with resin, so it imbues the fiberglass. It creates that strong composite. But there are many steps. There's heating that to cure the resin, and these molds can sort of serve as hot plates that heat up and make that happen. And then there's the internal structures called shear webs, which could be wood and foam. That's the insides of these blades before it all comes together. And the really critical part here is the adhesive. It's this bond paste, and it goes along, the whole length of these really long blades. And just a fun tidbit on this process, it's, there's different materials that are mixed together. And once they combine, it's what's called a pot life. And you only have a certain amount of time to get that adhesive applied before its properties change, or it won't adhere the way it needs to adhere. And, some manufacturers will use different colors for the mixture so that when the materials come together, it creates maybe a green color or a purple. And this is just pulling out of my head here, but they'll be able to see visually, hey, do we have the right ratio based on the shade and the color that this pot has achieved? And so, it can vary by manufacturer, but generally there's this multi-step process, and ultimately it ends with these clamshells being brought together. More heat is applied to cure and everything for it to come together. And then the molds are removed and some finishing needs to happen, and then painting, and the blade should be done after that.
You have some great visuals that accompany the story, too, at the New Bedford Light website. GE has not said a lot about what happened with this blade and why it may have failed, but it does appear to be a bonding issue, and they've been examining blades, and it appears that they're sort of reworking blades to address this issue. There's an enormous amount of money at stake here. Because even like right now, the company has fallen behind in installation and manufacture of power, right?
Yeah, and also think of the added cost, not just to maybe, as they say, they're repairing blades, but also the cost of days at sea of hiring vessels. We reported that blades were removed from at least two turbines. So that's, more days at sea for these specialized installation vessels. That's, it's no small chunk of change. The added length to the construction, it's definitely added up beyond just the fixing the blades. It's hiring all the vessels that are needed to address the issue, to send blades, to France, for example, or to Canada. And so, it is a lot. And we touch on this in the article, but, a government report discusses that, it's a concern that might grow again as these blades get bigger and bigger, is just repairs can become more costly. And also the downtime, the time that these wind farms or turbines aren't operating, it's just going to get more expensive just when these generators have greater power.
What do we know about where Vineyard Wind is in the construction process right now? They had to halt power production while this was addressed. Where are they now?
So, we heard from BESI that Vineyard Wind has been permitted under different suspension orders to continue with some construction. We heard from BESI that blades will actually be allowed to be installed on a case-by-case basis. I heard from BESI yesterday, which
BESI is the federal agency that's overseeing this. Okay.
I was about to do that. I'm using these acronyms. But yes, the lead safety, oversight federal body that, is regulating this. And so that they're allowing, some installation of blades. But this is all a long way of saying, this issue has slowed construction and it's delayed things. Officials had originally at the beginning of this year said that they planned for the project to be complete by the end of this year. We know for sure that that's not going to happen. Vineyard Wind did extend its lease at the staging site in New Bedford through at least the end of March. Monopile installation may be finished by the end of the year, but there's a lot that still has to happen after that.
Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And, of course, Anastasia Lennon there from the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.